You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration has already launched war against Iraq on one very critical front. In the court of public opinion, attacks and counterattacks have raised the level of tension in this war on terrorism. But in many ways, words rather than violence have fueled a desire for revenge and war. Today, in the first of a five-part series produced by Radio Netherlands called War of Words, we look at who's talking and what they're saying. The program is compiled and presented by Michelle Ernstein.
And we, the democracies of this world,
we will use whatever means are necessary to achieve our objective.
Propaganda is one of the oldest weapons of war. Words and images which appeal to people's darkest fears and secret hopes. Words and images which may allow them to shed their humanity and join in the slaughter of a foe. The world's democracies have brought propaganda to its highest form. A system which relies on majority consent develops sophisticated methods for achieving it. Today in The Producers, from Geneva, Johan Galtung, the father of peace studies. From Amsterdam, Sees Hamelink, professor of international communications. From New York, Steve Rendall of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. From London, Peter Norlander, campaigner for free speech with Article 19. And also from London, Alan Davis of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
Propaganda doesn't have to be Goebbels trying to demonize the Jews in Germany and having the rats run along the sewers and stuff like that. It doesn't have to be as blatant and as crude as that. Propaganda can take many insidious forms, and so we just actually have to be much more aware of terminology, of language being used.
Saddam Hussein is a homicidal dictator who is addicted to weapons of mass destruction.
And Bush, the Satan, has perpetrated his crime.
Al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime will be eager to spread false propaganda.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
In the name of Allah, most merciful and compassionate.
May God bless America.
Whereas, let's say in the Second World War, you had a little department of 10, 11 people, and they sort of made it up as they went along. Now you have huge, great organizations, consultancy or pressure groups formed to actually try and influence public opinion, trying to influence television coverage.
The oldest technique of propaganda is just simply lying. That's what's usually called black propaganda.
Professor Sees Hamelink.
That has been decreasingly popular because it's a bit too easy to find out. So a much more refined technique, which is much more often used, and which was widely used, for example, during the Gulf War, is grey propaganda, which means that you lie a little bit, but you also combine it with the truth. You find sort of a combination of these two elements. That is usually fairly effective because there is a point of reference in reality where people can say, yes, you know, but this happened. But then you combine it with something which is not true. That's a classical technique which is very often used nowadays. Of course, another technique which is widely used is just the way in which you employ language. You make things sound not as dangerous as they might otherwise sound. Like, for example, no, you don't talk about a battlefield, but you talk about a theater. And you don't talk about, you know, bombing people into oblivion, but you talk about laying down a carpet. So you make it look like as if, you know, it's almost like gentle. Another classical technique which has happened, you know, over the past years quite regularly is character assassination. You describe the enemy as the most evil person, as totally inhuman. You dehumanize your opponent. You make Saddam Hussein into a Hitler. You call Milosevic a Hitler. You make just everyone a Hitler whom you don't like. You know, that's usually fairly effective as well.
The dictator is a student of Stalin.
I think that there is a kind of a pattern which comes up again and again, which is very simple and which is the formula behind all propaganda.
Peace activist Johan Galtung.
Try to make people believe there are only two parties. Don't make it complicated. And in this there is an enormous contempt for people.
either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Point out very clearly who are the baddies and who are the goodies. So who are the good ones and who are the evil ones. And point three, make it look as if a battle is inevitable, that there can be no other way than violence.
The great battle has been initiated, the mother of all battles, between the triumphant truth with the support of God and the evil pushed by Satan, which will be beaten eventually, God willing.
And I call that a DMA pattern, dualism, manichaeism, Armageddon. And it is very, very pronounced in the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, but only in the hard branches of them. And the hardest of the hard are the fundamentalists. Right now, after 11 September, we see very clearly two fundamentalisms at work. So they both operate that way. The two parties, one is evil.
Today our nation saw evil.
We are good.
And we responded with the best of America.
And the battle is inevitable.
We have now no choice. So we will act. And our determination in acting is total.
I think, however, there is another point which is more subtle. And that is the dehumanization of the other as a person without a cause. These are rebels without a cause. They have only one cause, and that's to be evil.
It is perpetrated by fanatics who are utterly indifferent to the sanctity of human life.
So you then come, of course, to the conclusion that the only way out is to crush them.
And eradicate this evil completely from our world.
If you come to that conclusion, and you can bolster it by the argument that arguments won't make any sense, and to sit down and talk with them makes no sense because they have no other cause than evil, then you have essentially reduced them to bacteria, to microorganisms. And you make use of the same approach as is done when we try to approach microorganisms with antibiotica, seek and destroy.
If you want to exercise so much violence against an opponent, if you want to use so many weapons and so many bombs and throw so many daisy cutters and kill in the process so many innocent civilians as you always do, you need to have a very strong moral justification.
I want him held. I want justice. And there's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, wanted, dead or alive.
And the best moral justification is indeed to describe the opponent as the absolute evil, because the only way in which you deal with absolute evil is only through military means. You also need to make people believe that you're no longer dealing with human beings, because for most people around the world, I mean, we are an aggressive species, that's certainly true, but most of us don't kill each other. But it's very easy to make people kill each other. Once you make people believe that the opponent deserves to be eliminated because the opponent is evil, the opponent poses a fundamental threat to your own welfare. And moreover, the opponent isn't really human. That's why you always see these references to inhuman beings. Like, for example, during the Second World War, Nazi propaganda would describe Jews as rats. Now, something like that happened, for example, during the Gulf War when the Iraqis were described as cockroaches. You just got to kill them. It's vermin. Eliminate them. And that's the most powerful, I think, tool that propaganda can deploy. That is the spreading of what I'd like to call the elimination belief. See, the normal people, in many situations, like, for example, in the Second World War, many Jews were killed by ordinary German citizens, ordinary men and women. Same thing happened in the Balkan countries. The same thing that happens all over again. And that only is possible when you make people, through very effective propaganda, believe, you know, that others deserve to be killed.
Today our nation saw evil.
This
evil.
Mass terrorism.
I fear no evil.
Is the new evil in our world today.
Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil.
Mud sticks. If you continually say the same thing, maybe you say it in different ways, like a lawyer, you'll actually start to build a case for, let's say, an invasion. If we start to look at what is now happening in terms of Iraq, the Americans are now sort of pulling out, saying their work in Afghanistan has been done. And already they're on phase two, which is building a consensus against Saddam Hussein. Now, the man may be a very, very bad bugger who needs to be replaced by his own people, but actually starting to build up stories that are not very easy to prove or disprove about biological weapons, chemical weapons, dirty bombs or uranium bombs, or all these kind of things is starting to influence public opinion. So public opinion will not be upset when there's a huge, great army ready to move in to Iraq. Are they actually expecting to go into Baghdad and topple the regime? Baghdad's a long way away from the borders, so that's going to be, you know, a very, very, very bloody campaign that will kill a lot of people. To do that, they've actually got to really demonise not just Saddam Hussein, but the Iraqi people, because there will be Iraqi people who will be killed. People should be aware and should be just spotting stories that have been, not say planted or manufactured, but start to see how the mood is changing.
You've got those who have an interest in describing reality in a certain way, to create a certain definition of reality in which Saddam Hussein, you know, is a bastard and in which he is no good and in which Osama bin Laden needs to be killed. That's a definition of reality. We deal with an extremely dangerous situation. We deal with terrorism. The reality will be defined in such a way. Now, of course, in order to bring that message to people at large, to your audiences, because this is, you know, one of the problems in any kind of democratic arrangement, that you need to have sort of, you know, like the moral high ground, you need to have sort of a constituency to support you. It's much easier to go to war in a totalitarian state. You don't have to ask all these citizens, you know. So there you have a problem, because citizens, you know, you can never really trust them. So you've got to manipulate them. You've got to make them believe that this is all right. Now, there's intermediaries, and that's maybe corporate interests, there's probably oil interests, there's military interests, there's arms sales, there's all these things. And then you have people at large, who probably, by and large, you know, all would just want to live in a peaceful world and wouldn't want to necessarily go out and kill people they've never seen before. You've got to say that there is always a certain level of dissent, you know, even within the way in which you frame reality. I mean, during the Kosovo War, there were always people who said, but is this a wise idea, and should you throw bombs, and maybe you kill innocent people, and so on and so forth. That's the kind of criticism within the frame. Now, once people step outside the frame, as, you know, as characters like Noam Chomsky do all the time, but they're considered to be very nasty characters, because they're very upsetting, because they say, maybe the frame isn't right, maybe the definition of reality isn't right, maybe it's about something totally different. Now, why do people, by and large, not react to that in a relieved way, as if they would say, oh, great, now we know if reality is more complicated. Good, you know, I want to hear more about what Chomsky has to say. Well, of course, because, and again, one can understand, it's very disconcerting, it's very disquieting. It's very nice to believe, you know, that there's awful things happening in Kosovo, and that NATO is going to stop that, you know. They're going to end there with force, you know, they're going to bomb these people into accepting human rights as a standard for the way in which they conduct themselves. And we're going to go after the bastards, you know, who kill people in the Twin Towers. That's a nice, simple scheme. That's nice, you know, it's nice. It's black and white, it's right and wrong, you know, it's very clear. And of course, most people want to conduct their lives with fairly simple schemes, because life is difficult enough for most people, I mean, to get through. Life is a complex proposition for most people.
You're saying this is a war, and in previous wars there has been censorship. You're saying that type of thing is not now under consideration at the White House?
Keith, that is not censorship. This is a request to the media, and media makes their own decisions. Larry?
Just wondering, is this request only to American media and therefore the American public, or are you saying, you know, that you wish media all around the world would stop?
Well, I've reported to you what Dr. Rice did in a phone call this morning,
okay,
and so you have that. I'm getting there.
Okay.
And so I reported that information about what Dr. Rice did, in fact, pick up a phone and ask for this morning among the people she called.
How forceful has the government been in trying to keep the media in line?
Media analyst Steve Rendell.
You do have Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor. You have Ari Fleischer, the president's press secretary, and several other people from the Bush administration coming out and warning the news media. And that seems to have had an effect. I mean, as if the news media wasn't already very much in gear with the White House line, Ari Fleischer came out and said, Americans should watch what they say, watch what they do. Now, that was quite shocking to a lot of Americans, but the reaction it got from a lot of the big corporate media was quite different. A lot of Americans said, how dare he say that to us? How dare he? Now, what was the reaction at CNN? Walter Isaacson, the president of CNN and formerly the editor of Time magazine, came out and said, whenever we do a story about civilian casualties, we've got to remind viewers what happened on September 11th. I mean, it's not only a shameful caving in to the White House, it's also an absolute disrespect for CNN viewers. So, in fact, what CNN has done ever since Walter Isaacson put that memo out to all of the reporters and producers under him, what they've done every time they mention a civilian casualty in Afghanistan, they'll generally show video footage of September 11th. And this is a complete acquiescence to the White House agenda. So there's been a profound effect, because not only because of their natural predilection, the corporate mainstream media in the United States has a natural predilection to go along with whatever the official agenda is, but in case they got any idea of having an occasional dissenting point of view or doing a story that might not put the United States government in the best light, well, you know, the White House came out and said, you know, you've got to watch what you say, watch what you do. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, called a meeting, had a phone conference meeting with the presidents of all the major networks. And it wasn't for news. It wasn't a news conference. It was to tell them what the U.S. government would like to see from them.
There has been a lot of very improper contact between government and the press.
Free speech campaigner Peter Norlander.
These have all been in the form of more or less informal approaches where, for example, the UK government has had a meeting with BBC, ITV people just to discuss, quote-unquote, the way that issues of terrorism are covered. The United States government has actually also tried to interfere with the way that foreign stations cover issues of terrorism and cover specifically anything related to Osama bin Laden, in that the sense that they actually approached the country in which Al Jazeera is based, Al Jazeera being the main Arab language satellite news station, and they tried to get the government there to rein in, as it were, Al Jazeera, because they thought that Al Jazeera's reporting on anything related to bin Laden was quite inflammatory, and they tried to get the government there to actually hold back Al Jazeera's coverage. These are really very, very, very improper attempts to interfere with freedom of expression.
Good afternoon. It was a year ago today that the global war on terrorism began, when U.S. and coalition forces commenced military operations in and over Afghanistan.
One of the reasons that Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, conducts daily Pentagon briefings, where before that would generally be done by some spokesperson for the Pentagon, is because he wants complete control of the message and of any information that could come out. And he's been very, very unforthcoming and has not given very much information at all to, and in fact, quite deceptive. I mean, he's said, for instance, that this is, you know, this is the most precise war ever. There's been less collateral damage, fewer civilian casualties, which is ironic because he tells us he can't tell us how many civilian casualties there are, and then he says there's been less than ever before, which is untrue. I mean, there are independent groups that have studied this, but the U.S. government has been very tight-lipped about a lot of the information since September 11th.
Access to government held information has now become quite problematic, particularly in countries such as the UK, where there's a fledgling sort of freedom of information law that is only just about to be implemented, and where a lot of information now is still being accessed through informal government arrangements. That has certainly tightened up. In the United States, the Freedom of Information Act is now also being applied more strictly as a result of this USA Patriot Act that was enacted by Congress just after the 11th of September. Also, there is far less willingness among officials to actually release information on the grounds that to release it would be damaging to national security. Now, of course, the officer, the public official who makes this decision autonomously. He's the one that makes that decision, and it's, on the whole, it's not going to be reviewed. So it's very much the point of view of one public official in this department who think it's going to be damaging to national security, and that is the be-all and end-all of it.
The United States government, for the last several years, has been trying to privatize public information. presidential papers are being withheld. George Bush, the current president, is trying to privatize and put his own personal papers off limits. This is the same trend that we're seeing now, where the U.S. government has bought up all the satellite photography of Afghanistan and of Central Asia that's being done. Why is that being done? It's being done to deny access to the U.S. and international press to those same pictures.
Well, that's what you call information management. It's one of the leading techniques also in propaganda. You know, you just make certain that you select and filter whatever you want the audience to see. Of course, there's been an awful lot of imagery. It couldn't be any different because all these satellites have been taking all these photos, so there must be an enormous amount of material. But once, of course, you know, you are not certain whether that serves your purposes, then you simply censor it away. Either, you know, because the satellites are government-operated, or you make certain that the commercial satellites don't sell the imagery to the press. Now, to some extent, you know, you must wonder whether that is a wise strategy, whether it would have made any real difference. I remember from the Gulf War when the Bush administration announced that it would go into the ground war because there were massive Iraqi troops getting together close to the border of Iraq, and there was a real danger, you know. The satellite imagery at that time showed that there were no Iraqi troops close to the Saudi border, and yet it made no difference for the world press. They still, you know, believed that there were massive Iraqi troops, although they could see with their own eyes that they weren't there.
February 19th, 2002. The New York Times reports that the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Influence is developing plans to provide news items, possibly even false ones, to foreign media organizations in an effort to influence public sentiment and policymakers in both friendly and unfriendly countries. The Pentagon hired the Rendon Group, an international communications firm, to help with the new office. 1 week later, the New York Times reports, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has disbanded the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Influence. The Rendon Group, however, still works for the American government.
If you want to have a message out effectively as a government, I mean, it makes sense that you turn to the professionals who know how to do this, and who know how to do this for commercial reasons, so they could probably also do this for other reasons. And so this is precisely what happened, for example, during the Gulf War, when one of the major international public relations firms, Hill & Knowlton, was engaged by the Bush administration. I think they got something like $10 million or so, which is not an awful lot of money, but still enough, you know, for them to create stories, like the story about the Kuwaiti nurse who saw the Iraqi soldiers taking babies out of the incubators and killed them, which is totally untrue. The story about the birds in the Gulf region who were the victims of Saddam Hussein's, you know, putting fire to the oil fields. There's a large number of stories that come up all the time, and for which you need indeed professionals to do that, and PR agencies just apparently now allow themselves to find that morally acceptable and just do that.
When you take this Hill & Knowlton, which was the name of the press agency that was hired by the Kuwaiti side and which was then hired afterwards in Yugoslavia together with other agencies, if you look at that, what they do, of course, is to add to the evil on the other side by making stories of that kind. And this was done during the First World War. It was done in the Crimean War. It's an old thing. And would add to the propaganda. And, of course, it would also entirely neglect the evil done by one's own side. Like, for instance, the killing of civilians. And here there is some kind of fighting over the numbers in that connection. There are major factors. The incubator story went all over the world. Didn't seem to damage Hill & Knowlton the slightest, even if it was pointed out that it was a blatant lie. I myself had contact with Hill & Knowlton, and I was told that our task is to train and to teach our clients how to get their message across. Our task is not to test and check the veracity of their message, but we could tell that person how to present the message on television. And it was very well presented. Our task was not to go into Kuwait to find the truth about incubators. Well, one can see it. One can understand it. It's terrible. And the terrible thing about it is not that Hill and Knowlton does this. The terrible thing about it is that media give them space. So evidently they're very effective. It has been reported that about 40% of foreign news in the United States has an origin of that kind. In other words, it comes from public relations organizations. So it means you can buy your image.
Well, it's very convenient, isn't it? Because, you know, and it's, of course, totally against the very structure of any democratic arrangement, in which the crucial concept, of course, is public accountability. But, of course, you know, if you're going to tell lies to people, if you're going to use black, grey, and other types of propaganda, you know, you're not likely to want to be very accountable for it. And in a way, it's a nice trick to have these things all, you know, be executed by private agencies. So but the private agency doesn't have any public accountability. There will be no parliamentary kind of investigation into Hill and Knowlton. And the government, of course, can always claim that, yes, you know, they engaged an agency, but they want to really distance themselves from the agency because they just went really overboard. You know, they did things, you know, that they never intended to do. And, of course, they can always claim they never really knew.
What amazes me, in a certain sense, is not that people are gullible once and twice and three times, but that they are gullible four times, five times, six times. That's a little bit surprising. That people don't simply learn not to trust a single word of what comes out from those kinds of quarters. Well, that'll probably come, and when it comes, it'll come like an avalanche of distrust, where lots of babies will be thrown out with the dishwater. In other words, you can imagine situations where not a single word from a foreign minister and ministry will be believed. And that's also going a little bit too far.
It's always being said that in a war, the first casualty is the truth. But, of course, immediately related to that is that the second casualty is the desire to be told the truth. Many people don't want to hear. And, for example, now we know that during the Gulf War, when people were asked about the Pentagon censorship in the USA and in the UK, a majority of people said they thought it was quite all right. They didn't want to hear what happened. No one can claim today that you could know about what the reality behind the Gulf War or Kosovo or Afghanistan really was. You could, because there's so much information available. I mean, there is alternative news services around the world. There's an alternative international news agency, Interpress Service, which reports very differently about these matters from AP or Reuters or Agence France-Presse. There's, of course, an enormous amount of information on the Internet. The trouble, of course, is, again, it's complicated because it implies you've got to spend time. My point of view would be, well, that's part of wanting to live in a democracy. See, democracy is not an easy system. It comes with a price. It comes with a lot of active involvement by the citizens. Now, if you don't want that, then apparently you don't want to have a democracy. Well, then go to a totalitarian state. Then you don't have to think. People will think for you. Most people, you know, would be very happy with the way in which Walter Cronkite always did it at the end, you know, of his newscasting. He would always say, and that's the way it is. That's nice to live. You can go on with your own business because now you know how it is. You don't want to be told the truth. Also because of the truth is really unsettling. I mean, if you were to believe that your own government, you know, is complicit in killing of innocent civilians who should not be killed and who are killed for the wrong reasons, that's very difficult, because then also, why is that upsetting? Because then also, you know, it would be by implication be your moral duty to do something about it.
You've been listening to The Producers, part of the Sound Fountain series War of Words, compiled and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
Thanks go to Norwegian peace activist Johan Galtung, Dutch professor Sees Hamelink, American media analyst Steve Rendall, from London, free speech campaigner Peter Norlander, and media trainer Alan Davis.
Part two of War of Words will air a week from today on Peace Watch. Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance today from Marcus Tyler Brown. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.